Afternoon, welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is October 12th, 2002, and this is your host, Michelle Steinberg, Counterintelligence Co-Director of Executive Intelligence Review and editor of EIW, our electronic magazine. So today we could say this. This week, some might say the lunatics took over the asylum when the United States Congress and the United States Senate voted to give unfettered imperial power to President George W. Bush for his war against Iraq. Is it his war, or is this a war that's been planned by a bunch of lunatic Armageddon millennialists and a nest of Israeli agents who have been working on this agenda for more than 20 years? We learned late this week that one of the people involved in linking the state of mind of the president with the Christian Zionist lunatics is the key speechwriter, Michael Gerson. He's the former chief aide to the ambassador to Germany, who has been on a rampage there after the German Chancellor Schroeder and leading members of the German establishment, and of course the LaRouche movement led by Helga Zepp LaRouche in the election there, had opposed the imperial war with Iraq. What's the connection of the Christian Zionists, the Israeli right-wing fanatics around General Ariel Sharon, the German and European opposition, and the folly of the U.S. Congress? That's our topic today. What Lyndon LaRouche called earlier today, the separation of church and mental state, which we'll discuss with the candidate whose leadership stands out around the world for the United States and for the betterment of the world situation. That's our guest, Democratic Party presidential candidate in 2004, Lyndon LaRouche, who's on the line with us from Germany. Welcome, Lynn.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. Let me say 14 years ago, on Columbus Day, October 12, 1988, you were in Berlin, in the shadow of the Berlin Wall, a divided Berlin, and you forecast that the time had come for that Berlin Wall to come down, and that Berlin should be restored as the capital of a unified Germany. You said these things at the apparent height of the Soviet Union, and you were right. Germany was unified. The Soviet Union fell. You were exerting real leadership. Now, ironically, the United States today is trying to be an empire. The American people, unlike the American press and the members of Congress, who may privately be dismayed, but publicly goose-stepped their way into giving Bush his power, but the American people are frightened, dismayed, horrified that the president, well, he might be mad. You led the opposition to the Imperial Iraq War, and I'd like you to tell us, those of us who don't want war and destruction, what to do.
Well, it's interesting because my speech in Berlin on Columbus Day of 1988 was actually an outgrowth of a policy I'd been working on for some time, since about 1977, when I had begun to realize we had to stop at the direction things were being moved in by people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was just becoming the National Security Advisor for President Carter. But as a result of that, I got into a brief discussion, very brief, with a presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan, in New Hampshire at a gun show appearance of several thousand people. And as a result of that and some other things, in the immediate transition period, I met a number of people who were coming into the new administration with whom we had certain points of agreement as well as disagreement. And I laid on the table a number of projects I was working on, which I thought the new presidency should pick up on. Now, many of them were not accepted, but some were. One which was accepted a little bit after the inauguration was a proposal I made, which later became known as the Strategic Defense Initiative. Now, the Strategic Defense Initiative became quite a football after the president announced it officially as such on March 23rd of 1983. And what was being pushed by the Heritage Foundation then and now is a bunch of junk, which wouldn't work then and wouldn't work now. But what the president and I proposed as taking it out of the mouth of the president for what he said publicly in that five-minute segment on televised on March 23rd, 1983, it was my policy then and is my policy now. Now, the problem is this, which brings the whole business right up to date to where we are right now. My policy was then that of what is called strategic defense. Strategic defense as a concept was elaborated in Europe in the experience following the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia. It first came to the service in France in practice by a great military leader of France during the early 18th century, a fellow called Vauban, a great commander who built fortifications at places like Belfort and Neuf-Brisach, as it's called, which were undefeatable up to the point of the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71. That is the Belfort. It's the one place in France that withstood the Prussian forces during that period. The Lazare Carnot, during the time of Louis XIV's reign, wrote a paper in defense of Vauban, in praise of Vauban, which outlined a policy of strategic defense based on engineering and logistics, that instead of going out to fight wars against nations, one must develop a capability of strategic defense which would defeat an assault and would thus allow the nation to press for peace over any adversary attacking it. This same policy was adopted in Germany by Gerhard Scharnhorst, the founder of the modern German military system prior to Hitler time. This was also became the policy of the United States, especially after 1814-15, when West Point was retooled under Presidents Monroe and John Quincy Adams, retooled around this idea of strategic defense. So the traditional policy of the United States, as we saw with MacArthur's conduct in the Pacific during World War II, or the U.S. policy in World War II, was one of strategic defense. We did not have the best fighting force in the world in World War II, but we had the best logistics developed under Roosevelt intentionally for the contingency of war. And we won the war with logistics, even though the German military was man for man much more capable than any other military force on the planet at that time. So that's been our policy. Now we come to a period in the post-war period in which people call utopians. And the whole crowd was built around two guys. Herbert George Wells, best known as a novelist, but actually a leading member of British intelligence, and Bertrand Russell. They developed a policy of utopianism. Their policy was that the development of nuclear weapons, which Wells had proposed as far back as 1913 in a preface to one of his books.
1913, that is decades before such a thing existed.
Yeah, well, no, he had he was working on the work of a fellow called Frederick Soddy, a chemist who worked with Rutherford, and they had worked through the idea of radium as a weapon.
Mm.
So it was the idea of Soddy on radium as a weapon, which was Wells' first proposal to use nuclear weapons, as a weapon of terror to force nations to submit to world government. By that, he meant really Anglo-American world government. Then Russell pushed through the development of nuclear weapons going into World War II with the idea that in the post-war period, he would use nuclear weapons for preemptive warfare. The same preemptive warfare is what is coming out of the president right now. Preemptive warfare, not against an attacking adversary or even a capable adversary, but someone you wanted to eliminate just in case they might mean something in the future. It's contrary to all our policy. As Senator Byrd emphasized correctly and emphatically in the proceedings which were just concluded in the Senate. But anyway, so that was our policy. But Russell came along with this idea. He got the RAND Corporation, through his network of friends, people like Szilard, Wigner, and so forth, a whole bunch of cronies, and they got through the RAND Corporation, around the idea of creating the Air Force as an independent arm. They set forth in the United States, from the end of the war, both the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, for which there was no military purpose at that time. Japan was already a defeated nation. We never had to invade it, so no million lives were saved by that bombing. But the bombing was set forth in order to introduce a policy that through a triad of nuclear weapons deployed by land, by sea, and by air, that we'd be able to intimidate the world into submitting to world government. In 1946 and beyond, Russell continued to propose a preemptive war, nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. And that was his policy, which was defeated. This was defeated essentially by the election of President Eisenhower. And Eisenhower kept these nuts under control, at least to some degree, as long as he was president. However, as soon as he got out of the presidency in 1961, Kennedy was not capable, but Kennedy did not understand the military problem the way Eisenhower did. And Kennedy did not have the influence with the U.S. military to check the military forces the way that Eisenhower had done. So with that point, the world began to go into this period, which included the 1962 missile crisis and so forth, which led into a policy of nuclear standoff and a permanent nuclear terror as a way of bringing about world government to end sovereign government, including that of the United States. Now, in the 1970s, that's what I was up against. And it was getting ripe under Kissinger. Brzezinski was a more active nut than Kissinger and pushed much harder. And he had a crowd about him which were pushing for preemptive nuclear war. That was the policy of the Brzezinski group, 1975 to 77, coming into power. They ran into frustrations, but it was there. So I attacked this problem. I said, how do we deal with this system? We're prisoners of nuclear terror, mutual and assured destruction. So I went to work and said, look, nuclear weapons are not indefeatable. We cannot defeat them right now, but they're not indefeatable. There are new physical principles which, if applied, we develop weapon systems which could take out a full-scale ballistic attack. Not all of it, but most of it. Now, the point is not to develop a super weapon of defense. That was not my purpose. The point was, as Reagan expressed this in March of 1983, and again at Reykjavik on October 6th and 7th, 1986. Reagan's policy, as opposed to the nuts of the Heritage Foundation, the Danny Grahams and the other nuts, mm-hmm. His policy was to get the Soviet Union to come to an agreement on the coordinated development of these kinds of weapons to free the world. That is, the two leading superpowers would agree to free the world from the terror of nuclear attack, not by mutual assured destruction, but by developing superior systems, and to use the cooperation in advanced technology to benefit the civilian economy of the world, including both powers. Now, that was the policy I pushed through. I worked on the technicalities of that with the German military, people like the late General Kass and many others in the German military, with the leaders of the French military, with the leaders of the Italian military, and so forth and so on around the world. We had, in 1982-83 and beyond, we had an international agreement among top specialists in science and military leaders, some serving, some out of service, but an agreement on this policy. It was my policy. Now, what I had done, because the Reagan administration put me into a back-channel discussion with the Soviet government. This is 1982-83. And during that period, we had these discussions. In February of 1983, the spokesman for the Soviet government, meeting with me, reported back from Moscow that the Andropov government would reject my proposal if the president were to offer it. Remember, the president had never offered it at that point. I warned him. I said, look, if we agree and this is agreed to, this policy will save the economy of the Soviet Union, which is in the process now of disintegrating. They said if Andropov were to reject the proposal after the president made it, I can guarantee you that the Soviet government would, the Soviet system would disintegrate in about 5 years. So now, 5 years later, or less than 5 years later, 1988, as a presidential candidate, I presented a policy in Berlin and said, we are on the verge of the collapse of the Warsaw Pact system. And what the next government of the United States must face, this fundamental question is, how is it going to deal with the collapse of the Soviet Warsaw Pact system? I propose that we do the same thing that I had proposed with the SDI. Propose cooperation with them to bring about a positive peace rather than a negative one. And so they got me out of the way right away. But my proposal was based on my understanding of what the economic process was, both in the Soviet system and in our own system, that the United States, I knew, had been on the road to self-destruction. Now we've reached the time. The Soviet system died in 1989, 1991, about 6 years after I had warned it would under those conditions. Today, we're now on the point, we're in the worst world depression in the experience of any living person on this planet right now. This system is coming down. It's coming down hard, like you've never seen before. The only thing that'll save this, us, now, is a return to policies like those, that is the attitude of a Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration. Not exactly the same policies, but changes in policy which take into account the benefits of that experience. We can save the U.S. economy. It will take a generation of work to put us now back to where we were as a powerful economy back in the mid-60s. We can do it. We can save the world system. We're also on the verge, if we don't do that, we're on the verge of chaos. So the significance of what's going on now, you have a president who has needs to know the difference, as we take with this Gerson case, is he has to discover the difference between church and mental state. Because what we have on our hands, the Gerson case illustrates it, you have a certifiable dangerous lunatic who's using the language of Armageddon freaks and inserting that language into the speech of the president, like the recent speech. And this, they are disorienting this president to the point of insanity by giving him no alternatives for dealing with the economic crisis and pushing him into a war he doesn't understand and that will destroy his presidency and probably our nation too. And that's the problem we face. We can get out of this. The other problem is that I face what happened in the Senate, despite the efforts of Senators Byrd and Senators Kennedy and a few others, is that insanity and cowardice took over the Senate by voting for this unconstitutional, lunatic resolution. What it now happens that I, as a Democrat, am the only leading Democrat in the United States at this moment on the issues of war and economy. That is, no other leading Democrat, as a national leader or prospective presidential candidate, has the slightest bit of credibility or competence at this moment on questions of how to deal with the war or, above all, the economy. So that's the similarity. We lost a lot of time. We suffered a great deal of destruction because I was out of the way and because George Bush's father, together with Margaret Thatcher and Mitt Romney and a few others, went the wrong way in 1989-1990 on dealing with the breakup of the Soviet Union. They destroyed the world economy rather than using the opportunity to build it up. Now we're at later, a dozen years later, we're now at a new breaking point where we can either go to war or we can come to our senses. Put the lunatics back into the churches, let them have their churches, but don't put them in the White House. And in this frame, go ahead and work on rebuilding the economy. That's where she stands right now. That's my experience, and that's where I stand still.
Thank you, Lynn. Lynn, I understand your campaign is going to be putting out another mass leaflet, follow on to the series of leaflets that we had over the summer, around the theme of the Electable LaRouche and themes like the Pollard Affair Never Ended. This one is called The Evermore Electable LaRouche Tells You What You Must Do About the Economy Now. So there's a solution on the table. And the first question I want to take up is from another LaRouche candidate, this one from Connecticut, Lori Dobson, Democratic State Representative candidate in Connecticut in Lieberman area, who asks if you would elaborate on the economic plan for reconstructive economic recovery. Before you answer, let's just mention that there was very big news from Brazil, from another candidate who took up your economic policy, Dr. Aeneas Carneiro, who received an historically unprecedented earthquake, making 1.5 million votes for the federal Congress from Sao Paulo, where you were made an honorary citizen. So we've got two candidates, one who won, one who's facing an election in a few weeks, running on the LaRouche policy. Can you comment on Lori Dobson's question?
Well, first of all, the first thing we have to do, and we have to force the president to do it, and not force in the sense of holding a gun to his head the way some of these crazy loonies are, but rather very simply, we have to make clear to the president, maybe through his father, maybe through circles, whatever it takes, that he, as president, with the support of the Congress, must put through the appropriate emergency legislation to do immediately, right now, before the election, two things. One, emergency legislation. Call a special session of the Congress. See, look, the Congress isn't doing much useful anyway up there campaigning anyway. Get them back in on the question of the economy. Two things. One, the national railway system. We have to stop the bleeding of the national railway system. That is, stop stop the disruption right now and start to reverse to rebuild. Number two, we must intervene with the imminent collapse of United Airlines into bankruptcy. And many other airlines will go with it if we don't stop it. We must have emergency legislation which takes the situation over and stops the breakup of our national air travel system. Those are the two first test cases of the will and temper of the American people, the Congress, and the presidency. If they don't do those two things, they're not in the real world. Right? That's number one. And Lori will understand exactly what that means in terms of the Boston to New Haven to New York route of travel.
Right.
Commuter travel in the greater New York area and in the Connecticut area. It's obvious. We need that now. We need that for two reasons. First of all, we must save these two institutions of infrastructure, whether privately owned or public. We must save them for the American people, otherwise we are not going to be able to rebuild this economy. So those are test cases of the will and intelligence and competence of government and of the Congress. We don't care what Phil Gramm says, he's going out anyway. We do it. This is also to set into motion the will and commitment for expansion of employment in the U.S. economy, not junk employment, but basically economic infrastructure employment, and also to reactivate some of those essential industries which are on the point of plunging into bankruptcy now. Look, the entire automobile industry is on the verge of collapse. You know what that means for employment in the United States? Would you take what parts of the United States depend for their employment upon the automobile and related production? No, we can't have a collapse in that sector. So we have to use infrastructure development as a thrust where the government gets the credit mobilized for low-cost, long-term, we're talking about 25-year, long-term program of rebuilding and maintaining essential infrastructure. Not only in transportation, we have a power crisis. That must be addressed. We have a water management crisis, including freshwater crisis and sewage handling in many parts of the country. we have a problem of distribution of electricity, not only production. We've got to get back to an integrated, regulated, state-regulated, federally assisted program of combined, integrated production distribution of electrical power and other power. We must have a water management program. We must rebuild essentially our urban centers. We are insane in what's happening with our urban development. We must fix that for future benefit and for present employment. We must rebuild our health care system. We must return to a Hill-Burton policy in health care, under which the federal government, in cooperation with private interests, in cooperation with states and counties and municipalities, will go back to the Hill-Burton objective of providing adequate medical care in terms of beds as a measurement of medical care, beds by type, in hospital facilities in every county in the United States. We must go back to that system as opposed to the system which broke down after 1973 under the HMO. We must also recognize that we've gone into a post-industrial society as reflected in an educational system which is no longer producing people for survival in an agro-industrial climate. We are no longer educating people for competence in an effective economy. They don't have the skills, the education, the knowledge needed to function in a healthy economy. They are being educated for a broken down, dying economy. So these are the areas. We then have to have a high technology orientation for international trade. There are tremendous potential markets for long-term investment in Eurasia, in rebuilding Africa, and in rebuilding Central and South America. We must build up those industries in the United States, which are export industries, export-type industries, which produce products of the type needed on the basis of long-term credit for developing the infrastructure, industry, and agriculture of Central and South America, Africa, and Asia. The biggest market in the world is Asia. China, Southeast Asia, the subcontinent of Asia. Also, there is the Central and North Asia, which are presently undeveloped areas with tremendous natural resources. We can get access to that as a part of the whole process if we assist in the kind of infrastructure development which will make those areas of raw materials accessible to the world market. So we have alternatives, but we have to start moving down that road. We have to give the world the confidence that we are once again sane, that we as the United States are going to respond to our tradition and provide the focal point of leadership, not domination, not imperialism, but leadership, bringing nations together around a common purpose with our weight put on the scale of this progress to rebuild the world economy and get out of this destitution, get out of this decadence, which has seized us for the past 35 years, especially the past 20 years. Get out of that and go back to being sane Americans once again with a future for our children. The thing you see that I see that many of you may not see, I see out there in 18 to 25 year age groups, young people of college age, university age, with no future. The baby boomers of this country have to wake up to the fact that they have given their children no future. And the way to define our morality is to think of those young people, age 18 to 25, university age, who have no future right now on the way things are going, and think ahead to their children coming a generation later. Are we providing for ourselves today, for those young people today, and for their children to come, are we providing a future for them? That's the test of our morality, and that should be the primary focus of our idea of national security. Can we have secure relations among nations? I believe we can.
Okay. I have to take a break right now, and station and show identification. You're listening to Lyndon LaRouche, candidate for the Democratic Party presidential nomination in 2004, leader of the Democratic Party, and author of the proposal for a new Bretton Woods monetary system. This is the LaRouche Show, a weekly audio talk show broadcast live on the internet every Saturday, featuring interviews with Lyndon LaRouche's associates and special guests. I'm your host, Michelle Steinberg, counterintelligence co-director of Executive Intelligence Review. And you can reach us when we're not on the air through our toll-free number, 1-888-EIR-3258. Please check out our website at www.larouchepub.com. Going back to the show, Lynn has just outlined a challenge to the American people to embrace the American intellectual tradition and his leadership, which is being taken up around the world in places like Brazil, where his collaborators have gotten unprecedented votes, among a youth movement which says we do have a future. Now, Lynn, you're bringing hope, and there's a lot of fear about personal safety, jobs, etc. You called for the President of the United States to take some emergency action, forget waiting till after the election, job program, infrastructure program. There's another dynamic going on, and a number of people have asked me to ask you this. A supporter in Northern Virginia said, I wonder if you'd like to comment on a rash of sniper killings in the Washington, D.C. area. There are many aspects of this. They point to different things, professional military intelligence operations. In short, the killings have the entire D.C. area in a state of fear. Can you tell us what you think on this?
Well, I think there's certain things that should be said and some things that should not be said. There's a tendency of people out of desperation to go around shooting their mouths off with suppositions in a crisis. This is typical of bad police forces, which when they have a crime they can't solve, they say, let's assume somebody did it and let's go out and arrest them and put them in prison or shoot them or something, without finding out first who actually perpetrated the crime. Now, what we have on this thing is we know that the pattern of escape, that is, the shootings as such, don't tell us much except the obvious, that somebody is doing a sharpshooting job, probably with a telescopic sight of some sophisticated rifle and a sophisticated type of ammunition. That's all that tells us. However, the fact that in each of these cases so far, the perpetrator has escaped detection means that this is unlikely, an unlikely, improbable event, unless somebody is providing an escape mechanism in advance to back up the shooter, or shooters, as the case may be. Therefore, we have to assume that there is an operation involved, not an individual shooter. That the operation has organization, it has sophistication on the level of at least a police force. That is, people some to investigate crimes learn from that how to commit them. So, and it could be military, it could be something like that. We don't know. The important thing is to emphasize what we don't know and don't go shooting off in a wild direction out of desperation. We can also know that since this is obviously an organized effort by someone unknown, that the effect that it's producing on the population is an intended effect. In other words, the purpose is to do somewhat the same thing that would have happened on September 11, 2001. Now, we know a few things about 2001. We still don't know who did it. And the president nor anybody else has given any evidence that they know who did it. The idea that the Afghanistan Taliban did it, that Osama bin Laden, there is no evidence worth anything to show that. We have some peculiarities of it which tell us something. The attack was on the Twin Towers in New York City first rather than on Washington first. That tells us that the purpose was to provoke a reaction from the U.S. population to go after Arabs. So whoever did that operation, and it was an inside job inside the United States, not necessarily by the government as such, but by forces with capabilities of controlling government capabilities to do that. And whoever they were pushing for this result, which some of the chicken hawks, such as Bridget Pearl and company, had been pushing for over a decade, especially since 1996. So we know that much. We don't know who did it. And I've always insisted, don't assume who did it. What we have to know, is what we know, both in that case and the present case around Washington, D.C. We know it's an operation. It is targeting the U.S. population psychologically in the way that the purpose of the operation of September 11th, 2001 was targeting the U.S. president and population psychologically. Therefore, we have to know that. We have to be cool-headed about it, and we have to get to work on it. But don't go assuming that because we haven't got the answers, we should run around like chicken hawks with their heads cut off, demanding that we do this or that or so forth. The worst thing that could happen to us is somebody runs ahead with a supposition that they think they know who did it without any proof and start looking for reprisals against the person who they suspect might do it. That's the worst thing that could happen. And you would be playing into the hands of those who are running this type of operation if you did.
Thank you, Lynn. There really is those who are trying to build panic about this. So that's helpful. We have more calls than I have ever seen for a single call. We could have an entire international conference today. I'm going to try and manage it in the following way. Out in Detroit, Lynn, we have a campaign meeting going on. Listeners, Michigan is the state where in 2000, Lyndon LaRouche got well over 20% of the vote in the Democratic primary. Al Gore was in a mode of stealing LaRouche's votes, and we ended up with this mess in Washington because of that. Let's not let it happen again. Detroit is another area, Michigan is another area where the electable LaRouche Democrats have won an election. Kerry Lowry is one of the people at that meeting. I understand there's three people ready with questions. What I suggest we do, John Asher is hosting the meeting out there. I suggest we hear all three questions and then have Lynn answer different aspects. Is that okay with you, Lynn?
Sure.
Okay, let's go to Detroit then.
All right, here we are in Detroit, just a few minutes from Ford Motor Company. I want to read these questions. The first one submitted is the following. If the current financial oligarchy plans social, political, and economic chaos for the planet, then what is their vision for the aftermath? And the next question, which is a question that also I've myself received from a number of people since I've been here, is the following. The Muslim community in the United States it has been terrorized by the current administration policies, especially after September 11, 2001. Muslims and Arabs were also targeted by ERIRA, the immigration reform bill that was signed by President Clinton in 1996. The fear of further government retaliation is significant and justifiable. What can you tell them now that will assure them their commitment and long-term peace to overcome the fear they face and live in, for them to take an active role in your campaign? The third question really is more of a comment, which is how are we going to revive the steel industry?
Okay. Well, first of all, the aftermath of this event in Washington is, as I said just a few minutes earlier, that the Senate, the entire Democratic Party leadership in the Congress as a whole, with a few individual exceptions here and there, has been totally discredited on the issues of war and the economy. They're a bunch of weak-kneed cowards who have capitulated for fear of not getting their campaign contributions from a crowd in New York and Detroit and so forth. And they have no view of the aftermath. They have no policy. They are they're like chicken hawks with their heads cut off. They're running around, wild in the hen yard, running wildly but with no place to go. On the question of the Arab persecution, well, the only way you can do that is get Americans to stand together against it. Look, this is a McCarthyite type of witch hunt, and some people remember what that is. Now, I happen to briefly be involved in fighting against McCarthyism, and then Eisenhower came in and sort of put his foot on it and stopped it. And Truman had turned it loose. One of the reasons that Truman was defeated for re-election was that he had allowed it to run. He had started it, and it run rampant under his administration, despite his complaint about it. So this kind of thing. We stand together behind a leadership that will not capitulate. We're going to deal with it. Secondly, what we need is more than just standing on the issue. What we need is unity about a programmatic approach. The world is now in the worst depression. Nobody has experienced in the United States or Europe in their lifetime a depression worse than that which is coming on right now. That is going to determine all politics. Therefore, if we take a united stand against the war, and remember, the majority of Americans right now are against the Iraq war, despite all the baloney from Washington. The majority are against it. I've been looking at the figures. They're against it. So therefore, we have to take a firm position of leadership against the war of the type the Senate did not reflect, and the House certainly. Gephardt is finished as a leader in this country for what he did on this issue. Yeah? That we have to also have a positive approach on providing real security for real people, including economic security. If we stand together, as people stood together around Roosevelt, then we can bring these policy problems under control. And I think people know that I'm not the problem on this. If I'm in power, you don't have a problem with this kind of thing, unlike some others. On the steel industry as such, look, we're going to have to rebuild everything. We have processes which improve processes, which we put on the back burner over the period from the middle of the 1960s on, especially in the 1970s. We tore down most of our steel capacity. But at that time, we had capacity to develop improved processes for steel and metals generally, which we just didn't bother to go ahead with. In building an infrastructure program, one of the big challenges we have is transportation. That means rebuilding a national rail grid, which has three components. It has long-range rail transport. That is, we must be able to transport goods economically and efficiently and in a timely fashion from any point of production and large-scale purchase in the United States to every other point of production or large-scale purchase in the United States. We must have that kind of grid, a national rail grid. We must supplement that with a high-speed rail, which will mean also magnetic levitation rail, especially in transportation in high-density corridors, such as the corridor from, say, Portland, Maine, or so forth, down through Boston, through Connecticut, through New York City, to Washington, D.C., and below. And so forth, several places around the country. So this in itself is going to consume a lot of steel and similar kinds of product, metal product. We also must develop water management systems. We've destroyed. We tore up a lot of steel that was being used in agriculture for irrigation. We sold it for scrap, reprocessed for scrap. We're going to have to build that water management system again. We're going to have to build power generation and distribution systems to fill the gap now. That's going to take a lot of steel. And this is going to be the hard core of priority on rebuilding our basic metals working industry, processing and working industry. We're also the key for the future lies in breaking free of the scrap of old technologies and going into new technologies which produce a qualitative better type of goods than we produced earlier. We also will have vast markets in South and Central America and in Asia for participating in programs of development of infrastructure and industries. This will take a lot of metalworking. one of the functions of the Ohio, Detroit, and adjoining states, immediately adjoining area, is to restore an area which had these skills, which remembers these kinds of skills, remembers this kind of production, to make it once again a machine tool center of the economy of the United States. And that's what I'm committed to, not because I'm committed to doing something good for Detroit or something good for Ohio, but because that is what makes sense for the United States.
Okay, Lynn, we have a crowded organizers conference line, and there's about 7 people with questions. We're going to ask Bob Baker to get people ready, and let's have 3 of the questions asked to you. And then I can tell you that we have 2 calls from the campus movement. One, the editor of the University of Montreal newspaper there, Sebastian Malo, who sent us an email question, and an African-American student from with questions that they encounter on the black campuses. So we'll go to the conference line, then we'll I'll read you the student questions. Go ahead.
I'd like to know, sir, realistically speaking, how much influence, I know you have great influence, how much, because you're not covered, I guess, in mainstream press, and when I talk to people about you, a lot know your name, don't know quite where you stand. I guess I'm trying to gauge just exactly how much influence you really do have, and if that is enough influence to bring this organization to achieve the objectives which we seek to achieve. And I mean, I ask this question in all due respect, sir. I'm just trying to gauge.
I got you.
I'm trying to get a gauge on this.
Okay, good.
Okay, the next comment, we'll take 2 more questions from the conference line. Please identify yourself and the state that you're from.
Abdul?
Okay, speak up.
Or Doris.
Doris, this is Doris.
Speak, ask your question.
Okay, Mr. LaRouche, it's concerning your comments against or towards the Christian right. I would like to suggest that we find a way to reach them rather than use language like crazy lunatics so that we don't alienate them and get them to understand that if they think about their Bible, Jesus came to take away hate and war, and he would not send us into war against our brothers. Do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Doris. One more from the one more questioner from the conference line. Is that Joe from Texas?
No, it's Christine from Massachusetts.
Okay. Okay, Christine, thank you. I'm going to have to repeat that because you were breaking up a little bit. Lynn, the question from Christine is to comment on NEPAD, the organization that was set up, we've written about an EIR that supposedly is solving Africa's problems. What's really going on there? Let's not leave Africa behind, says Christine. So 3 questions. Go
okay,
ahead.
Fine. First of all, on influence, influence is like a street walker. He was looking for a customer. And the political influence in the United States today is walking the streets looking for a customer. It just lost a customer called the Congress. People who want something, who have any sense, know they're not going to the Congress for it right now. And therefore, I'm filling a vacuum. I have more crucial influence around the world probably than any American outside of the top positions of government as such. In other words, you're going to Asia, you're going to Europe, you're going to Africa, you're going to South and Central America. As typifies it, let me just case of Dr. Aeneas, who was referred to earlier, just as an example of this. Dr. Aeneas is a cardiologist, an outstanding cardiologist, and some years ago, a political formation was assembled in Brazil, centered around doctors who were concerned about what was happening to Brazil as doctors. And they sought to be a political force change some of the policies of the country from the standpoint of a physician looking at the needs of a nation. He's a brilliant fellow, and he hosted me recently in a visit I made to Brazil in May, where I was made an honorary citizen of Brazil in a very elaborate and, I must say, ostentatious ceremony with military bands and full panoply of routine. You think I was being inaugurated President of the Earth or something. It was very, very nice. Dr. Aeneas, we talked, and we discussed his prospects in the coming election in Brazil and role. I discussed it with his close associate, Dr. Javier Mintz, who was a leader of the city council of Sao Paulo, which I think is the third largest city in the world, in that time. And they asked me what I thought about his position in running for parliament, because he's run for president before. I said, in this exceptional case, I thought not only that he was a good idea, but I thought he would be very successful at this time because of the conditions developing in Brazil and South America in general. Now, he just came off with a 1.5-plus million vote election to Congress. This is unprecedented in the history of Brazil. No member candidate for Congress has ever gotten as large a vote as he has. The second largest vote winner among both congressmen and state legislator candidates was his associate, Dr. Javier Mintz, who's a dermatologist. He's a leading cardiologist, a professor of cardiology, who teaches about 200 doctors a year in cardiology. So he came out with his vote. Now, he is the only leading candidate who did not sign on to an IMF agreement implicitly for the election. So he comes out with a vote which stunned all Brazil and stunned the IMF and stunned Washington. They are panic-stricken about this so-called unknown, who is not really unknown, but who came out with a leading vote, who now controls and will control a fraction in the parliament of Brazil. They're freaked. The two leading candidates, among all, were Dr. Aeneas Carneiro and Dr. Javier Mintz. So this is an example of how influence goes today. Stick to the right program on the right issues, and at the right time, if you're there and others fail, you'll get all the influence you need. And that's the case with me. I'm well recognized around the world already. I'm a power factor in world politics. I'm a power factor now in Washington politics. No one can estimate what my influence is, but they have to say is as great as anyone else's in terms of what it would be like, say, a year or two from now. On the second question, on this, what is this?
The Christian right.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. Now, when I say crazy, I mean it. I mean clinically insane. Now, you have two kinds of insanity in life. You have individual insanity, which is clinical insanity. You also have forms of mass behavior or group behavior in which the individual may not be ordinarily insane, but when they're functioning in a group, the group as a whole behaves insanely. Now, the collective political behavior of the Christian right, so-called, in the United States today, is not only collectively insane. It's dangerous, its influence is dangerous to the health and welfare of every American citizen. These guys are like lunatics throwing bombs. They're not throwing their own bombs. They're getting the President of the United States to throw bombs. And the effects on that will be terrible. Now, yes, you're right in one thing. Your criticism of me is wrong, but you're right in the positive side. The positive side is that Christ did not come to, shall we say, give man a program. Christ came to redeem all human beings, an act of love of Christ, Jesus Christ. And that is Christianity. And that is, so therefore it is correct to counterpose healthy Christianity, real Christianity, to fake Christianity. And what is called the Christian Zionist is fake Christianity. is a cult of a very dangerous type. And these people are sick. They need help. As individuals, give them help. As a group phenomenon, they're nuts. On the question of Africa, well, I don't have much of a problem on Africa in dealing with it as a personality. I mean, I'm a friend of Africa, one of the few real friends Africa's had, and I've been that for a long time. Africa has no chance right now. No one in Africa can, inside Africa today, is capable of assuring the survival of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. No one. There are good people in Africa who, with assistance from the outside and some protection from things from the outside, could organize internally the measures by which, with assistance, they could solve the problems of Africa. But there is no such thing as a purely internal solution for Africa's problems today. There is a prospect of organizing within Africa people who are natural leaders of Africa, who, if they have cooperation from outside Africa, can do the job needed. The basic thing that Africa needs economically, it needs a grants of assistance in developing basic economic infrastructure, which involves several things: transportation, especially rail, water management, power generation and distribution, this main trunk stuff. Involves health care, such as disease problems. Diseases of plants for agriculture, diseases of cattle, diseases of people. That is needed as infrastructure. Africa needs massive assistance for this problem. The so-called AIDS problem is exactly one of these problems. It needs to be able to develop educational systems to meet the needs of development of Africa. I'm committed to these things. I know people in Africa who represent commitments of that appropriate type. We must support them. We must support them by concrete measures. That's the only solution.
Lynn, thank you. We have gone longer than our usual 60 minutes. That's fine technically. People can listen to a repeat of this interview at www.larouchepub.com. Thank you very much. I hope we have you on again very soon. If you would like to make any closing remarks, I think your last comments stand, and we have an army, a political army out here waiting to distribute your leaflet. So for the next half hour, we'll be working on that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think watch what happens around Dr. Aeneas and Dr. Javier Mintz in the coming period in Brazil. That may be a harbinger of which way the world is going to go during the next immediate weeks.
Talk to you soon, Lynn. Thank you.
See you.